At Emory University, we believe in those with the ambition to achieve, the passion to learn, and the optimism to see the possibilities ahead. Founded on a belief that the wise heart seeks knowledge, an Emory education combines experiential learning in Atlanta and beyond with unrivaled collaboration and discovery, all to prepare you for a world that needs your leadership. Learn more at emory.edu.
Hi, I'm Mike Dilk and you're listening to the Relax Back UK show, the show that explores all kinds of health topics relevant to you, your family and your friends. Each week I talk to expert guests from a range of backgrounds to inform and entertain you. So please do join the Relax Back UK family and stay tuned.
Hi, and thank you for joining me on the Relax Back UK show. Continuous glucose monitors have become very popular recently.
What we found is that in people who don't have diabetes, these devices tend to overestimate our blood sugar levels on average.
I look at them and see if they really work with Professor Javier Gonzalez, Professor of Nutrition and Metabolism at the University of Bath. Then something that is really rife at the moment in the UK.
Norovirus, which we've got this massive surge in at the moment, is the one that's often called the winter vomiting bug. So that tends to affect the gut. So it's diarrhea, vomiting, fever, feeling generally achy, tummy pain.
If you want to increase your chance of avoiding this thoroughly nasty illness, listen to GP Dr. Zoe Williams. And please do stay tuned for a great show. Thank you. My first question for Professor Javier Gonzalez was, what is a continuous glucose monitor and how do they actually work?
Yeah, so a continuous glucose monitor, or otherwise known as a CGM, is a monitor that estimates the level of blood sugar, so the sugar that's circulating in our bloodstream, at high frequency. So it can measure it every 5 minutes or maybe even every minute across a full 24-hour period, and you can wear these for days on end. So the idea is that they're giving us insight into the levels of blood sugar when we're sleeping and also after meals and when we do exercise and so on. But they're not actually measuring the levels of sugar within the blood. What they're doing is measuring the levels of sugar within something called interstitial fluid. And that's the fluid that bathes our cells, and it's aside from the circulating blood. And what we really want to know
is this fluid in our skin. I mean, I've seen the pictures. It's like a little sticker, isn't it? It's a little sticker with something sharp on one side.
That's right. Yeah, it's like a little sticker with a little probe, and that probe goes just under the skin, and it's sampling from just under the skin. So not in the bloodstream, just under the skin there.
So how deep does it go in? When you put the sticker thing on your arm, does it hurt?
No, it doesn't really hurt. You can feel it.
Really hurt? That's what people say. When actually, it does kind of hurt.
I'd use the term uncomfortable. Okay. But once it's on, you then forget about it and can't really feel it. And one of the issues comes in that it's not measuring what's going on in the blood. So what it does is it has to estimate that using an algorithm. So it's measuring in the interstitial fluid and then estimating what's going on in the bloodstream.
Okay. I mean, this sounds pretty high tech stuff. How long has this been around?
Yeah, they've been around to some degree for more than a decade. They were primarily used for people with diabetes to help them control their blood sugar levels. And previously, people with diabetes would have to continuously take finger prick samples, which are a little bit more painful than the CGM. So they're a great tool to reduce the need for keeping pricking your finger after every meal or before meals. And so on.
Yeah, so I was going to ask what people used before. So they had to get out a thing, get some blood, a drop of blood, out of their finger, and do a test on that.
Exactly. Yeah.
So if you are a diabetic, and that's what you're doing, how often do you have to do that?
Yeah, I mean, you advise to do it before every meal to check what your blood sugar level is and adjust your insulin dose accordingly if you're on insulin. But also, if at times you have sensations that you might be getting, your blood sugar might be getting too low, then you're recommended to do a finger prick sample then. And of course, the CGM has great use there because it can tell you if your blood sugar is getting low without you having to sense that you might be getting low.
So I mean, this thing sounds fantastic, because having to, you know, make a hole in your thumb or your finger or whatever and test the blood at least three times a day, you know, this is a major chore to your lifestyle, isn't it? I mean, these things sound wonderful, these CGMs.
Exactly. Yeah, they have been a great advancement in many ways.
And so because I knew we were going to talk about this, I did a little bit of Googling, which I know is a very dangerous thing, but you can hook these things up to your phone or up to, or maybe it goes via your phone to an insulin pump.
Yep.
So it detects a problem and automatically squirts a bit of insulin into your bloodstream. I mean, that is amazing.
Yeah, that's right. It is incredible. Incredible technology, yeah. And really,
so what do these insulin pumps look like and where do they go?
Yeah, so similar actually. So that they'll reside on the skin and can inject the relevant amount of insulin into the circulation, whereas previously, and still quite a lot of people just use the manual method where they check their blood sugar level and then they manually inject a little bit of insulin just under the skin as well.
So how big, if you're using one that's automatic, and you've got this thing kind of stuck onto you, and presumably that's got a needle going into your blood?
No, that one. So the insulin gets injected into the fat tissue. So you're just under your skin.
All right.
And yeah, they're very small as well. Certainly smaller than a mobile phone. So probably a matchbox.
So you have these things kind of strapped onto your arm, do you?
It can. Some of them go on the arm. Some of them go on the stomach. They can go in several places.
Okay. And yeah, and so you can, if you suffer from diabetes, you can have one of these things and you can lead pretty much a completely normal life. You can get on with it.
Exactly. Yeah, it really is life changing for people with diabetes. Yeah.
And so I came across an example which I think I had known about, but I was reminded of Theresa May. You know, had the top job. And she had one of these things and it enabled her just to get on with it. So, you know, if it can work, if you're prime minister, you can do anything, really.
Yeah, yeah.
It sounds almost too good to be true. Are there any issues?
Well, yeah, that's what our research started to look at. So as we've already discussed, they were developed for people with diabetes, but in recent years, they've been more and more used by people who don't have diabetes, who have pretty good blood sugar control anyway. And this is partly where some of the issues might arise, because these devices are estimating blood sugar levels. That no indirect measurement is going to ever be perfect, but the degree of inaccuracy that is acceptable for what we want to do depends on our goal and also the person. So for someone with diabetes, they've got very high blood sugar levels or swinging from very high to very low, then even if a device isn't perfectly accurate, then because the swings are so high and low, it's good enough to do the job that we're looking for it to do. Right. Whereas for people who don't have diabetes, our blood sugar levels remain in quite a tight range anyway. And so if we're using these devices to detect very small differences, then some potential issues could arise. And what we found is that in people who don't have diabetes, these devices tend to overestimate our blood sugar levels on average, but also it seems to vary between people.
How did you find this out? Is this published work? Did you do it with hundreds of people or half a dozen, one lunchtime? You know, tell me about the research.
Yeah, so it just came out this week in a peer-reviewed journal. So it's been through peer review, and it's in the American Journal of Clinical Nutrition. And what we did
is that a good one? How many points do you get for that one?
It's one of the best ones in our field. So yeah, very proud of it. Yeah.
All right, good.
We got a group of generally healthy people to undergo several different tests. So we studied them in the fasted state, so before they've eaten anything. And then we studied them after seven different meals and drinks. So they varied in the amount of carbohydrate and the type of carbohydrate in those meals. So then we could understand how well the device can capture the blood sugar response to those meals. And we compared the CGM with what's known as the gold standard or criterion method, which is the capillary, the finger prick blood sample method. And to further improve our estimates there, for every single blood sample, we took two measurements and took the average of that. So we've got our our criterion method that we're comparing to, and then at the same time point, we're taking readings from the CGM.
Okay. So essentially what you found was right, and it's been peer reviewed, and you know, it seems what you found out is correct. All right. So I suppose the next question has got to be, well, you know, does that really matter? Because what you've got is you've got a few people that are pretty fit anyway. They're kind of interested in their blood sugar levels. Essentially, they're the worried well. So, you know, they might eat a bit less sugar because this thing tells them to. You know, does that really matter?
Possibly not, but it could do as well. So it could be causing unnecessary worry. So because it's overestimating our blood sugar level, people might be getting unnecessarily worried that their blood sugar is too high when in actual fact it's within a normal range. It could cause them to change their dietary behaviours, and that might be beneficial, it might be neutral, or it could be harmful. So as one example, if someone is looking to reduce their blood sugar level, then they might switch to a lower carbohydrate, higher fat diet. And that in itself isn't necessarily a problem, but for some people and for certain high fat diets, particularly if they're high in saturated fat, then they could be increasing, for example, their levels of cholesterol, and that could be increasing their risk of, in the long term, of things like heart disease. So if they're only focusing on their blood sugar level, and especially if it's an inaccurate assessment of their blood sugar level, they could, in theory, make dietary changes that actually are a health detriment.
Okay, all right. Presumably, as part of this research, you can kind of tell me just how wrong, well, maybe you have already, but you can emphasize a bit more just how kind of inaccurate these things can be.
Yeah. Yeah. So one way of expressing this is in the units that we measure glucose. So normally our blood sugar level is in the fasted state around 4.5 millimoles per liter. OK, so that's the number. And for some people.
Milli what?
Millimoles per liter.
Millimoles. Right. OK. Yeah. So I like units. I just have this image of my physics teacher when I was doing my O levels, because I'm old, shouting at me, what are the units? It means nothing if there are no units. So thank you.
Exactly. So 4.5 millimoles per liter. And for some people, this overestimate was more than 1 millimole per liter. So the true measurement might be 4.5 millimoles per liter, and the CGM is measuring 5.5 millimoles per liter. So it is substantial.
Yeah. So that's 20% out.
Exactly. And one of the other ways we can express the blood sugar response to foods is known as the glycemic index. So if we give people pure glucose to drink and we measure their blood sugar response to that pure glucose, and then we give them another food and we see 50% of the response to pure glucose, then we would say that food has a glycemic index of 50. It raises our blood sugar level to about half what pure glucose does. Right. So that's one way we can classify foods as high glycemic index or low glycemic index. And what we found was that the CGM tends to overestimate the glycemic index of some foods that would normally be categorized as low. And the CGM might categorize them as either medium or as high glycemic index. So it misclassifies the foods.
OK. Are there any in particular that it tends to misclassify?
We haven't done enough foods to really see any general pattern there. The main ones we've tested are things like fruit smoothies, eating whole fruit as well. It seems to overestimate all of those to broadly similar degrees. It also may vary by person as well.
Yeah. Smoothies is kind of interesting because, I mean, everybody loves smoothies because they're nice, but so you can glug quite a big smoothie, but you would never sit down and eat like two apples, two oranges and one banana, which are probably in the smoothie. So you're getting an awful lot more sugar than you would do normally.
So you're getting potentially more sugar more quickly if you drink it versus if you eat it. We tested that
out a bit of fiber as well.
So if you were to have fruit juice, you don't get the fiber that would be certainly if you eat the skin of the fruit. So there are several differences between whole fruit and, say, smoothies or juice. We actually tested part of that as part of this study. We didn't see big differences in the blood sugar level between fruit smoothies and the same fruit eaten whole. That doesn't mean to say it doesn't have other effects, but at least just for our blood sugar level, it didn't make a big difference, actually.
Okay. So what does all this mean? Because, I mean, at the moment, there's a in the population as a whole, there's a real issue with more and more people getting diabetes for a host of reasons. I don't think there's one particular kind of reason. There are many variables, and maybe no one really knows the real reason. But anyway, a lot of people are getting diabetes. What does that this research, does it help with that or hinder with that? You know, what does it all mean anyway?
Yeah, I think, of course, the causes of type 2 diabetes, at least, are generally thought to be the combination of genetic susceptibility and ultimately energy excess. So eating too many calories relative to our needs. But once we're in that scenario, then the type and amount of carbohydrates really makes an impact on our blood sugar control. I think what our research adds isn't necessarily relevant for people with diabetes already, but it's for people who don't have diabetes. If they are trying to understand their potential risk of diabetes by understanding their blood sugar responses to foods, then probably a CGM isn't the best way to assess that. It could be causing them to unnecessarily worry that their blood sugar is too high, when in actual fact, it's still within a perfectly normal range. So I think CGMs still have potential use even within the general population, but we should be aware that they have this overestimate. And if we're unsure, then we should check with a finger stick sample.
Yeah, that is the real way to do it, isn't it? If you want to get a result that you can be absolutely happy yeah. with, you've got to make a hole in your finger and get some blood out.
Exactly. Yeah.
Okay. Interesting. Now, I'm sure in the press release it talks about other things you get up to, and it says that you are an advisor to Zoe, and Zoe provide one of these things. So I was thinking, goodness, that must put you in a bit of a difficult situation.
Yeah, well, fortunately, I did obviously share the data with Zoe, and fortunately, they're really open to continually improving the product that they provide. So I don't know what goes in the background, because I'm an external advisor. I provide advice and they can take or leave it. I'm sure they'll be doing work in the background to further improve their product.
Did they get involved or sponsor the research?
No, they weren't involved in this research at all. It was funded by Innocent Drinks, who make fruit smoothies. That's partly why we tested the various different smoothies and fruits that were on offer. It wasn't involving Zoe.
So you're kind of stuck in the middle, but of Zoe, you're saying actually this the monitor might not be quite as accurate as people are thinking, and then Innocent on the other side, you know, this monitor makes our stuff awful. And you're kind of stuck in the middle.
Yeah, and it's quite nice to take the scientific approach and understand what are the strengths and limitations with approaches, and just provide the data. The data is, and that's the evidence. And I'm keen to help any of these companies improve the various products that they can provide.
Sure. So, well, with that in mind, I mean, do you recommend people drink smoothies if they're worried they might be on the verge of being a diabetic or just in life anyway? Do you drink smoothies?
So I would recommend people aim to get a sufficient amount of fruit and vegetables in their diet in pretty much whatever means they would like to. Now, of course, large amounts of liquid sugars such as fruit juices and fruit smoothies could contribute to a high energy intake. So what I mean is that for the same amount of calories, it's easier to consume liquid calories than solid calories, and they don't fill us up quite as much. So I'm not saying glug down a load of smoothies, but in the typical doses that we have in those small bottles, if you don't have diabetes, then the effect on your blood sugar level is minimal, and that in itself isn't anything to worry about.
Right. And let's face it, they are really nice.
Yeah, and they're a good way to get a load of vitamins and minerals that form part of a healthy diet.
Okay. Look, this is fascinating stuff. If people are listening to this And they're either coming away horribly confused or less confused, but wanting to know a bit more. Because often resources about this sort of stuff can be very difficult, because the resources can be driven by some of the commercial bodies involved.
Yeah.
If people want to find good, sensible information that is not biased at all, where can they have a look?
Well, I think one of the best resources, if people want to understand if a food is likely to increase their blood sugar level or not, or the degree to which it will, is the glycemic index website. So there's a big database where you can just type in any food and it will tell you what the glycemic index of that food is. So if that's something you are interested in, I want to choose foods that are relatively low glycemic index, then that would be something I'd strongly recommend. Based on our data, I think people need to be a little bit more cautious about characterizing the glycemic response to foods based on these CGMs alone.
Okay. Anything on the NHS website? Often that's a great website for different stuff.
Yeah, NHS website has good general dietary advice. There's also websites like the British Nutrition Foundation, the British Dietetic Association. All of those have evidence-based advice that has been through some kind of review.
Excellent. Professor, this is fascinating stuff. Thank you so much for taking a few minutes to talk about it. And I've got a feeling this kind of discussion is going to go on and on. So I'm going to reserve the right to drag you back on to the Relax Back UK show in the future. And I'm hoping you'll be happy to come on at some time.
Absolutely. Yeah. Thanks for having me. And yeah, be delighted to join again.
UK Health Radio, the station that makes you feel good. The station that makes you feel good.
Dr. Zoe has been a guest on the show a few times and she's always a delight to chat to. So before I asked her about norovirus and all that and how to avoid it, I thanked her for just coming back.
It's great to be back.
Actually, before we start, I want to, because I'm essentially a bit nosy, you've been on a bit of a lifestyle experiment, and I have to admit I've been a little bit jealous. So is that still underway? Is it fun? Is it healthy?
Yes, it's very healthy. So I'm on the final leg. So just to explain what Mike's talking about there, my little boy is due to start school in September, and being very aware that once they start school you tend to feel a little bit trapped. We've spent the last year living abroad in different places. We kind of leaned into that whole Brexit rule and not being able to stay anywhere too long. So we've spent 3 months in Tenerife, 3 months in Tunisia, 3 months in Cyprus, and now we're on our final 3 months in South Africa, which is absolutely lovely. And it's just been, the aim has been to have a bit more quality time together as a family, spend more time outdoors, closer to nature, eating sort of more locally grown food, essentially living a little bit more like how human beings are designed to live. But it all comes to an end in April. We'll be back in the UK full time, back to all of the jobs, not just some of the jobs. And but it's been a very successful experiment. Digital nomad life, I recommend it.
All right. Well, it certainly seems to be working for you. You look very smiley and very, very healthy. So, but anyway, we should get on and talk about how the rest of us can keep healthy and well. And yeah, before the show I did a bit of googling, which obviously is very dangerous, but there's a lot of people with norovirus in hospital right now, and it's like 800 a day in hospital in UK. So my first question, I suppose, what's happening? Have we all forgotten to sneeze in our hand? Are we all becoming, we don't care about everyone else, and we just sneeze wherever we feel like and pass on the germs?
Well, we think of these seasonal viruses or winter viruses. There's the upper respiratory ones, so that's your coughs and colds, flu and COVID-19. And then norovirus, which we've got this massive surge in at the moment, is the one that's often called the winter vomiting bug. So that tends to affect the gut. So it's diarrhea, vomiting, fever, feeling generally achy, tummy pain. And for most people, you know, it only lasts a few days, but it makes you feel dreadful. But for those who are more vulnerable, so the very young, the older people, those with weakened immune systems, it can make them severely unwell. And as you say, it's putting a massive strain on the NHS right now. The thing about norovirus is it's highly, highly contagious. So how
is it passed on, actually? Is it in droplets? Is it sneezing and coughing and...
So it's more passed on from fingers, from touching things. So The virus can be, from touching surfaces, from contaminated food. So the number one way to prevent it from being passed on, other than, you know, if you're ill, staying away from people, is hand washing. But it's got to be hand washing with soap and water, because this particular virus doesn't get inactivated by alcohol gels. So you've got to wash your hands. So the advice really is, all of us at the moment, whilst there's an outbreak, washing your hands with soap and water. Obviously, after you've been to the toilet, hopefully people do that anyway, but also before you eat anything, and also at opportunities. So if you go into somebody's home, if you arrive at the office, if you've been on public transport, as you walk into a building, first thing you should do is go and wash your hands with soap and water for at least 20 seconds. And the second bit of advice around that is, because it's so contagious and it can make people unwell, and at the moment the NHS is really struggling with the burden of it, is if you're unwell yourself, to be honest, you're not going to feel like being out of the home anyway. You don't want to be too far from the loo. But if you sort of feel the symptoms coming on, get home, stay at home, rest, hydrate, take some paracetamol, and please stay away from work and school until you've been clear of the vomiting and diarrhea for two straight days.
So is that a problem? Do we tend to like soldier on a bit too much than is good for us, or indeed good for everyone else? I feel a bit unwell. I'll go to work anyway. I'll be okay.
I think some people do. And there's this research that we're going to talk about. So 2,000 people in the UK were surveyed, and it's research done by Sterimar. And actually 13% of people in that survey said that if somebody turned up at their workplace and they were showing signs of being unwell, they'd send them home. I think that, you know, for norovirus, absolutely right. For these upper respiratory sort of milder coughs and colds, I think it depends what your job is, doesn't it? If you can just as effectively do your job at home with a laptop, then it's a good idea to do so, because you're likely to recover quicker because you're more rested and you're not passing it on to other people in the office, potentially on public transport. And I think our attitudes have changed from, if somebody's off work with a cold, or somebody's working from home with a cold, rather than thinking of them as a skiver, we now think of them as, well, that's actually quite considerate. I'm glad they did that. That's a good thing to do. So I think there's been a shift.
There was one statistic about being in a lift. So if you're in a lift and someone's kind of snuffling or coughing, the number of people that try and hold their breath in the lift, and I was thinking, you know, some of the buildings in London are quite large. Surely there's going to be a spate of people keeling over and fainting in lifts because they're trying to hold their breath.
That in the shard or the gherkin, are you? No. you're going to fail at that one. That was over one in four people. So 27% of people said they'd hold their breath in the lift until they could get out. Some other interesting statistics. So, you know, clearly we've adopted these avoidance behaviours. So 34% of people said that if they were on the train and somebody started coughing or sneezing, then they'd switch carriages. 20%.
We're all English, you know, we're far too embarrassed to go, oh, I don't want to be sitting next to you and get up and go. I mean, do we really do? I'd be too embarrassed to do that, I'm sure.
I think we'd find ourselves in a battle between our very, you know, as you say, very British to be polite and stoic. So we find ourselves battling against that versus, oh my goodness, like if I stay here, I'm increasing my risk of being ill and I don't really want to be ill. I think that I would make my polite, I'd be like, oh, I'm going to be sat down at work all day. I think I'll stand for a bit, and I'd probably get up and then move to the other side of the carriage and stand. I was speaking to somebody about this earlier and they said they'd just get off at the next stop and move carriages, and the person would just think that they were just getting off the train.
Right.
But yeah, one in three people said they would switch carriages to avoid that person. In London, it was 56%. So, you know, people...
Well, in London, you've been out and about for the last year, but I'm sure you remember trying to get the train into London during rush hour, there is essentially no escape. You are jammed in against everyone else. And if the person next to you is sneezing away, there's not really anything you can do.
Nothing you can do about it unless you, well, you try holding your breath. But but no, you're right. On those busy trains, then that's why probably why 20% of people said they avoid public transport altogether in those months when coughs and colds are prevalent. I think, you know, again, that's not something that's an option to everybody. Some people are completely dependent upon public transport and probably just have to take their chances. Another statistic that I quite liked, Mike, because this is something I've always done, a third of people avoid touching door handles. So they'll use a bit of tissue or their elbow to get out of the loos or to get, you know, to get through doors because they're aware of the contamination on,
right.
on doors.
Is that something that you would recommend then? Sounds like it.
I mean, it's just something I've naturally always done because I've always thought you go to the loo. I've always, you know, give my hands a really good wash, good technique. Been taught in the NHS how to wash my hands properly.
You know what? My wife, she once did examining because she's a scientist and she had a job examining students on hand washing techniques. And it was medical students, and it was terrifying how many failed that bit. Anyway,
yes, and in my when in my training as a doctor, we did that was one of the things when we were taught. You use the blue lights, which shows shows the bits where you haven't washed it off properly, and it just shows how thorough you have to be. So I got to all that length to decontaminate my hands, and then go to grab a door handle on the way out of the loo. It just doesn't make sense to me. So yeah, I tend to take a little bit of toilet paper extra and use that to get out. I'm not recommending everybody does that because I probably look a bit odd sometimes, but it makes sense to me.
What about something that actually a few years ago people were doing, and they're asking questions about it, wearing masks. Now if people don't wear masks commuting anymore, if I was to wear a mask on the train into London, people might think I was a bit odd. But what do you think about that? Would that be sensible?
I see people occasionally. So I was back in London last week and I was in the big Westfield shopping centre and I saw a few people walking around wearing masks. I think what we've shifted to now is like in Japan, where it's the norm, people might be wearing a mask if they themselves are vulnerable, but also people might be wearing a mask if they themselves have symptoms. Because actually wearing a face covering, if you have got a cough or a cold and you do have to go out and you do have to go to work, can reduce the risk of it transmitting to other people. So in Japan, it's deemed polite to wear a mask to protect others if you're coughing or snuffling or sneezing.
There was so much information and misinformation about, oh, masks are rubbish, they don't work anyway. At the time of coronavirus, and I must admit, I didn't really believe all that stuff. So what's your thoughts? What's the standard thought now?
Well, I think what is deemed to be by the scientists to be effective is if you're wearing a mask to prevent your coughing and sneezing, hitting other people, then wearing a mask is not 100% effective, but highly effective for that. We're meant to catch a cough or a sneeze, whether that's in a tissue or in your elbow. So as much as possible, stop those droplets from spreading far and wide. So if you're wearing a mask, effectively that's catching your cough or catching your sneeze. So wearing a mask to protect others when you're unwell, it's not going to do anybody any harm and is likely to protect people. I think the thing people often forget about, other than these avoidance measures, this survey showed us that people are very keen to avoid others. But what we can do for ourselves to provide protection. So, we can't completely prevent ourselves from coming into contact with these viruses, but we can prime our bodies to be as effective as possible at of winning the battle against them if we do come into contact. So, supporting our immune system. And it's stuff as doctors talk about all the time. And I know people are like, you tell us all the time, we already know. But I'm going to remind people that having a healthy diet, but especially that focus on eating the rainbow, because fruits and veggies of different colours have different nutrients. So eat the rainbow and get plenty of fibre. Regular physical activity helps your immune system work better. Good sleep, good hydration, and trying to avoid smoking, too much alcohol and stress. But another thing people might not be as aware of is nasal hygiene. And it's becoming more popular. It's been around for decades. But using saline sprays or washers every day when you brush your teeth to look after your nasal cavity, and because the nose is effectively the first line of defense against these respiratory viruses. Your nose is designed to catch the viruses and get rid of
them. It's pretty good at that, isn't it? I mean, it's evolved over quite a long time to be quite effective.
Yeah. So nasal hygiene. So every day using a saline spray or saline wash, and it can, that can be effective for reducing symptoms. People have allergies and hay fever, as well as these upper respiratory tract viruses.
And
as
then
well.
if you do succumb, and we've spoken in the past actually about various traditional remedies, because everyone's got a traditional remedy up their sleeve. And in fact, I've taken some of what you've said, and I've put it in a book that I've written with guests that have been on the show, and I've quoted you some, with some good traditional remedies and whether we should use them or not. And if essentially, you know, traditional remedies are a good thing if it makes you feel better and you like it. You know, don't poo-poo them.
Putting things on your feet isn't going to help. There's lots of things about putting things
on your feet, onion in your sock.
Yeah. I don't think putting stuff on your feet is really going to help.
But chicken soup and that kind of thing. Ain't going to do any harm.
Absolutely. You know, chicken soup is, there's a good reason why, isn't there? One, it's hydrating. Two, it's got protein in. Your body needs protein as building blocks to help it get better when you're unwell. It's nourishing, it's comforting. So absolutely, why not? And over-the-counter remedies as well. For most of us, if we encounter these seasonal viruses, we'll get better within a few days. We just need to rest, hydrate, use things like paracetamol, ibuprofen to make you feel better. There are nasal sprays you can use to decongest as well. Just being patient with ourselves, which I think, you know, we don't have time to get ill, do we?
But no time for that, no. all right, so as far as the main topic we're talking about is trying to avoid this stuff in the first place, if people are listening to this and thinking, okay, I'd like to find out a bit more about avoiding all this grief in the first place and ways I can potentially do it, is there a good go-to source for some advice?
I think there's loads of resources on the NHS website. Patient.uk is a great website as well. Some great articles on there. So what you're looking at, avoiding seasonal viruses, but also supporting your immune system. Vitamin D supplement, that's something I miss. Important to take that. And as well as, you know, do take up the offer of any vaccines that are available to you to protect you from these viruses. And don't forget that just looking after your health generally, eating that rainbow, being physically active, avoiding stress as much as we can, all of these things do make a really significant difference to how well your immune system functions. And if you're interested in the nasal hygiene that I spoke about, have a look at Stérimar's website, stérimar.com/EN for their UK website, to learn a little bit more about that.
Excellent. Dr. Zoe, thank you very much indeed for chatting and giving us some good advice as ever.
Thank you very much. Nice to see you, Mike.
Thank you very much to my guests on this week's show. And they were Professor Javier Gonzalez talking about blood sugar measurement, specifically continuous glucose monitors, and Dr. Zoe Williams talking about coughs and colds, avoiding them, and in particular, avoiding norovirus. And please do remember to check out my book, Cut the Crap, Ask the Questions That Matter About Your Health. It's available on Amazon and Kindle. And have a healthy week until next week. Thank you for listening.
UK Health Radio, the station that makes you feel good. UK Health Radio, the station that makes you feel good.
Thanks for listening to the Relax Back UK show. Join me, Mike Dilk, again next week for more fascinating interviews and chat. If you're listening to the podcast version, please subscribe, like, and share it with your family and friends. And have a healthy week. Until next week.